I'm John Kroll. As the Academy Awards broadcast draws near, we're going to talk today on No Limits about the state of movies in Indiana. We're going to discuss challenges, and we're going to talk about opportunities. My guests are Craig Mintz from Indy Film Fest, Teresa Sabatine with Film Indy, and John Armstrong of Pegasus Pictures. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits@wfyi.org, find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about movies today on No Limits, specifically movies here in Indiana. Obviously, our hook is the Academy Awards presentation broadcast this weekend, but our focus is going to be a little closer to home. If you want to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimitswfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Craig Mintz from Indy Film Fest and John Armstrong of Pegasus Pictures. We'll be joined shortly by Teresa Sabatine with Film Indy. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hey, welcome. Thanks for having us.
It's good to have you here. So I'm going to ask just sort of the general question, which is, what is the state of film in Indiana? We'll start with John. Craig is directing here. He's already.
Well, I think you pulled a good panel together because we've got Craig, who provides opportunities for films to be seen.
Yeah.
You've got Teresa, who's here trying to make Indiana a more film-friendly landscape. And I guess I'm here talking as a production company who's trying to just give opportunities for local filmmakers to exercise their talents and showcase their art. So in terms of the status, I think we're all excited about, I think there's an energy here and things are growing in the right way. It's kind of a build it and they will come scenario, I think.
Field of dreams here.
There's definitely a groundswell. Like, you're seeing a lot more product come from local filmmakers, just, you know, not even just the guys that are here, guys or girls, I should say, that are here in the state, but a lot of them that got the training here, they're making movies out of state and now wanting to come back to state. So you're seeing a lot of really neat, interesting stuff come out of the state of Indiana.
Well, and you're, John, you are actually embarking on your second picture, right?
We actually wrapped our second picture. Yeah, we filmed our second film, Ms. White Light, back in October, November. So that one's in the can and in post-production, and will do its festival run this fall.
And tell us a little bit about that.
That's an interesting film. It takes place around the world of hospice, and it's about a girl who has the unique ability to put people at ease and remove fear and connect to those who are on their way out. But she's really socially awkward and unable to relate to anyone who's still got air in their lungs, right? So it's the same writer-director as our first film, The Good Catholic, which is now available on Netflix and Blu-ray DVD and all your streaming platforms. Same writer-director, Paul Schulberg, and his writing is always dramatic with comedic elements, I would say. So we've got some really, really talented actors in this film, and I think people will enjoy it.
Is it difficult, Craig, to pull filmmakers to Indiana?
To produce, to actually make here? Yeah, and I think the big hurdle right now is the tax incentive. A lot of states offer, you know, tax breaks or incentives for those filmmakers that will shoot in their state. They'll give them kind of a kickback on the back end through tax credits. Indiana currently does not have those tax incentives. They used to. They don't anymore, which makes it hard for filmmakers that are being backed by studios or big donors to say, hey, you know, I'm going to go shoot in my home state of Indiana, but it's going to cost us more ultimately than it would be if we went down to Louisiana and shot in New Orleans because there's just no tax incentive. So it's a big hurdle for a lot of folks to come back here and make film.
Or Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania. Yeah. For a while, it seemed like every other movie was shot there. We're joined now by Teresa Sabatine, I think, of Film Indy. That's almost your cue, right, about the challenges of attracting people here to Indy.
For sure. I mean, I think what's really interesting about Indianapolis and Central Indiana in general is that we have amazing talent. Our universities are graduating these students by the hundreds. I think John is an example of that. Our alumni are leaving. They can't stay here. And so we're seeing this gap between the investments that we need to create the jobs for the talent that we're already cultivating. And so that huge gap is just kind of sad, you know, and that's what we're trying to communicate to the lawmakers and the policy people is that it's not a lack of talent that we have. It's a lack of investment infrastructure. And that can be it can come pretty fast.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the inducements that other places offer?
So most other states, and the last data I saw that there were 13 states that do not offer incentives. The ones that do are somewhere between 20% and 30% on the dollar. And what's really interesting about the incentives, the way they play in the film industry and media in general, this is video mm-hmm. games, this is AR, VR, the new technologies are coming out, those are all incentivized as well, is that they're about placemaking where you are. So they're about investing in infrastructure, but they're also about that workforce. So most of the states that are offering incentive are offering 30 and sometimes 35% on that workforce development. And so they're creating those training opportunities and they're creating that uprising of that talent to start somewhere maybe when they graduate from university, but then gain those skills to move up, get higher paying jobs, get more experience. So that's what we're up against.
And what's been the reception when you try to suggest that maybe we ought to do things a little differently?
It's been an interesting year and a half. We've had some really positive conversations. I think what we're looking at really, the uphill battle, is just an understanding of what the film, media, and content creation industry is. There's just a gap in understanding. So when they look at the tech industry, that's something that they've taken the time to understand. That's something they've taken the time to wrap their arms around. And that's the same that goes back to manufacturing, agriculture, which we've been good at for mm-hmm. you know, many, many years. So this is really about getting them to look at the future of workforce, looking at automation, what jobs are not going to become automated in the sense that technology is going to replace the person. And what we're seeing in a trend is that content creation. You need those creative minds that are coming up with the ideas and implementing those ideas. And so when we're talking to the legislators and to the governor's people, we're saying, listen, this is the next stage, right? Indiana has done the tech thing. You're doing it well. You're succeeding. We love it. This is another piece of that puzzle for Indiana growth for the future and for the generations that are here now, but the generations that are coming. And that seems to land pretty well, but, you know, it's money. It takes money. And when you want the legislators to move on something that takes adjusting the budget or allocating funds, it can take a little bit of time.
Craig, you were looking like you were leaning in, like you wanted to say something.
Well, I was going to speak to that point as well. Like, you have this tech sector, and one of the biggest things that they need is entertainment and culture for their folks that they're bringing in. So, you know, that's kind of where I play into this factor as an exhibitionist when it comes to these films through the film festival, the movie theater, is, you know, they need creative outlets to be able to occupy their time and spend their money. So, you know, when films are made here, when film festivals happen here, when we create this culture, this groundswell, if you will, we're also on the other end of the spectrum. We're also bringing people together through, you know, watching movies, buying popcorn, you know, buying locally craft beers, you know, and goods like that. So it's kind of a bigger life cycle than just the production of it.
And sorry.
Go ahead, John. I want to jump in, but go ahead, Teresa.
To add to Craig's point, not only when you're bringing these companies in and these filmmakers, in which John will speak to in more detail, it's also the money that they're spending. And mm-hmm. so you've got an influx into your economy from a tourism perspective, but also job creation, also infrastructure development. And then you also have these authentic stories coming out about your place, right? So Indiana stories that we want to tell that create a better understanding of our actual culture versus the culture that people assume about us. And we really get that authenticity out there that we want.
John.
Yeah, it's really a no-brainer. And I think Teresa is exactly right when she talks about it's just an understanding gap. I'm going to say it's kind of willful ignorance. And I'm actually glad we have a chance to talk about it because I think some people who decide not to really investigate the issue look at our production company and say, oh, well, people can do it, so it doesn't need to happen. But what's going to help people like me is that if there's a tax incentive, it's going to be much easier for me to raise capital, which means I can bring in money from outside of Indiana into the state, which is going to raise the state's GDP and create an economic boom. So why would you not want to do that? And two, it's going to create competition for me, which if there's anything legislature likes, it's increased GDP and competition. The only reason that we decided to come to Indiana is because there is such a swell of media out there. There's so many TV series and films. It's a smorgasbord, so to speak, of content to view. And so we said, man, how can we even begin to stand out in this wide landscape? So we were like, hey, we happen to be from a state that's really underserved from a feature film standpoint. We're like, if we go there, then, you know, maybe we'll get some notice. Maybe we can kind of make a name for ourselves. And so that's what we're trying to do. But it'll help us to have this tax incentive, and it'll help the state to create more economic opportunity and more job growth. And as Teresa says, like, these are jobs that can't go anywhere. And there's so many examples of state backing for infrastructure and for businesses that do stand the risk of leaving Indiana. And we've seen examples of that. So to me, it's just a no-brainer. And I think if people really decided to take a look at it, they'd see the benefits to the state for doing so.
We're talking about the state of movies here in Indiana today on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. So, John, tell me a little bit about the story of how Pegasus came to be. First place, how did you come up with the name?
Well, my business partner is a huge John Steinbeck fan. So if you look on the inside flap of any John Steinbeck novel, there's a Pegasus there. And there's he said that it represented the characters of his films, that they were lumbering souls striving to fly with not enough wingspan, but plenty of intention. So we thought that kind of embodied what we were trying to do. But Teresa made a good point, too. There's a talent drain here in Indiana, and we were an example of that. I was a professional actor, so was my business partner, and so you got to jump ship if you want to work in the industry that we do, and we did. We went out to the world, but we're from Indiana. I went to Brownsburg High School, and he went to Greencastle High School. We met during our time at Indiana and made a lot of our connections there. So if there are any young people listening, I always say that the best connections that you can make in college are to your left and right. So make sure you don't make any bad relationships. But so those relationships carried on, and our live journeys reconvened in 2014 around the Good Catholic, and we said, hey, let's go back home and make it there with our friends in a town that we love. And so that was the genesis of our company.
What was the hardest thing about making a movie here in Indiana? I mean, given the fact that we've established a lot of the infrastructure isn't there, the investment and all of that. You kind of had to build all of that as you went along, I assume.
Yeah, we were definitely, we say, like building the plane as we were flying it and hope it didn't crash. Money is always the hardest thing. There's no fat cat pulling the strings behind our operation. So just finding enough interested people who are willing to take a chance on a small startup film company. But as Teresa said, also, wasn't a shortage of talent. I mean, there's a lot of people here who are ready and willing to work on our film crew. The community that we worked in embraced us. People wanted to see it happen. They rallied around our film. Every business in town was excited that we were there and excited to be a part of it. So the largest challenge is always raising capital, which is why tax incentives will be a big help.
How large a budget was the Good Catholic?
Modest.
I guess that one cover a lot of territory.
That one's public now, but it was around $500,000, which we can say now out loud. In the beginning, you don't like to broadcast your film budget because you want studios to think it cost a lot more than it did. So they pay you more. But our budgets are increasing.
But you were able to get Danny Glover and and John McGinley, right?
That's right.
Major talent.
Absolutely. And that's the other thing that people don't understand in the industry, that these great actors will come anywhere to do a good movie. And because there's so much content, if they don't want to act in a Marvel movie or, you know, don't get the next role in Transformers, they want to do a good movie. And so all those movies are under $2 million now. If you're making a movie for $5 million or between $5 and $10 million, you're doing something wrong. So they'll do films for a very small amount of their fee, and they'll get a profit participation on the back end of the film. And we had Danny here for like 12 days. So 12 days out of his life to do a great movie. He was happy to come.
We are talking about movies here on No Limits today. It is obviously the Academy Awards season. Our focus is not so much, though, on the big budget films coming out of Hollywood as it is the movies that are being made here in Indiana and that are being shown here in Indiana, the state of the film industry here in the Hoosier State. My guests are Craig Mentz from Indie Film Fest, Teresa Sabatine with Film Indie, and John Armstrong of Pegasus Pictures. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or track us down on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking today about movies in Indiana. It's Academy Awards season, of course, but we're talking really about the films that either are made here or are shown here, and how the film industry in Indiana is developing. My guests are Craig Mentz from Indie Film Fest, Teresa Sabatine with Film Indie, and John Armstrong of Pegasus Pictures. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. Track us down on Twitter at WFYI. Or you can do what a listener named Rocky has done and send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Rocky writes, "Just want to say thanks, and we fully support and love what you're doing. Teresa, thanks for all your hard work carving a path for filmmaking here in Indiana." So that raises the question. I mean, is there a community, really, of people who are supporting these efforts? I'd like to hear everybody's thoughts on that. I'm going to start with Craig.
Well, you know, I'll speak from the box office side of things. You know, much like the Good Catholic, I would imagine in screenings of Good Catholic, they were packed. I mean, most of them. So, you know, from an exhibition side, it speaks in the box office. And, you know, I can tell you from Indie Film Fest side, whenever we program a locally made film, whether it be a short or a feature, it's packed. It's not just, you know, the cast and the crew. It's their families. It's their extended families. It's their neighbors. So, yeah, there's a massive following and culture around these locally made stories. And, you know, just, you know, there's also that sect of people that really just want to see this happen in this state. So they're just out there, you know, pounding the bushes, trying to get people to come, you know, see these films and be part of these stories.
Teresa.
I mean, I think the most surprising thing about my work, and I guess not surprising, but uplifting thing about our work at Film Indie is the community that already existed and the community that's growing because of the voice that we're giving that community. So, you know, if you look at, we throw a yearly holiday party just to kind of gather everybody together, showcase the work that happened, create collaborations is our hope. And if you look at the people that came the first year and you look at the people that came the second, there were new faces in the second year. There were new things that came out of that. I think a lot of productions that were collaborations of those people meeting and getting to know each other. The most emails I get are looking for investment, right? So I've got young filmmakers of all ages, of all demographics saying, I have a film, I want to make it. I have a project, I want to do it. Do you have any access to funding? And unfortunately, we don't. But the energy is there, the talent is there, the ideas are there. And I think that the more we continue to talk about it and support it, the more it's going to grow.
John.
Well, my favorite part of The Good Catholic is the credits. So if you look at the end credits, there's a huge list of people who mostly businesses in Bloomington. It's a large thank you to everyone in Bloomington who gave us a hand. And so all those people on that list are not filmmakers. Those are businesses who are excited to see this industry grow and to be a part of it and to have it in their backyard. So there's certainly people, you know, filmmakers, those of us inside the bubble who are anxious to see it grow. But most of our investors were Indiana folks who'd never invested in a movie before and are excited now that our film is on Netflix and it's found its way to distribution. So, again, I said in the very beginning, it's like a you build it and they will come kind of thing. And when, think with the three people here, specifically trying to create a film-friendly environment to show the state that people want this, but it can't grow without their support.
How much of it is also, you know, what's going on now is that the process is really opened up to, I mean, the idea that if you made a film, the only way it could be seen was in a theater is now a thing of the past. And in fact, it seems to me, and I'm not as informed as the three of you, that some of the most adventurous storytelling is taking place on some of the streaming services and all of that. Does that create different opportunities for filmmakers, and does it change our expectations of what film should be? I'll start with John, but I want to hear everyone's thoughts.
Yeah, you bet. I mean, the short answer is absolutely. I mean, we get shelf space. That's what that comes down to. When we opened on iTunes, we were on the top banner next to Wonder Woman. I mean, how does that happen, you know, without iTunes? So a majority of our returns are made through streaming services like that. And so, yeah, it completely opens the landscape for independent filmmakers to have a go at it. And with technology now, we don't shoot on film anymore, you know, so movies are a lot cheaper to make these days than they were in the past. And the technology's there. The quality can be there. So, yeah, the streaming services totally changed the landscape.
Teresa.
And when talking about an affordability factor, I know a lot of independent filmmakers, you know, Sundance-worthy filmmakers that have been doing it for years that are now learning self-distribution. So they're cutting the cost of having that distributor take a percentage of what you would make in the market, and they're figuring it out themselves because they can go direct to those distributors, in this essence of iTunes and Netflix and Amazon. And so it's really opened up the possibility for you to kind of manage the life of your film or your project, which I think is rather interesting, and I think it's only going to continue to evolve. But like John said, it also creates space. So I think we're getting a lot more diversity of content. And when you talk about a four wall, which is what Craig's good at doing, that's the term in the business where you get a four wall for your movie. It is so expensive to get that done. And that's a huge cost to distributors. And when I was working inside at a studio like Lionsgate, we would actually have to pay to have a screening to get a certain percentage of like 80% approval to actually for them to afford to make that film a four wall or give it distribution in a movie theater. And so it's a tough game and it costs a lot of money. And so we've really cut out that factor by having these different distributors. And I think it's doing a lot of good for a lot of us.
Craig.
Well, and I think, to speak to Teresa's point, like it offers that diversity of storytelling. Like, and that's the adventurous stuff that's succeeding in the streaming platforms are stories that wouldn't have been told in a theater because, you know, it just didn't have that mass appeal. You take that mass appeal out of it. You know, and I always want people to come to the movie theater. That's kind of my thing. But, you know, you tell stories like Stranger Things or some of these things that you see on Netflix that you'd never see that in the movie theater. And people want it. Like, they crave it sometimes very passionately to the point where then somebody's like, oh, well, I can make my movie now because that audience like that. So now I've got this content, you know, that I can make and distribute through Netflix or self-distribute or whatever that is. It just kind of – it opens up this territory of, like, content and storytelling that was never really available before. Or if it was, it was never available to, like, a mass audience like it is now.
Well, and is it changing, you know, the way we look at movies and the way we look at filmmaking? I'm thinking we did a pre-record for a show that's going to run – at the beginning of April with Alila Bundles, who's written about Madam C.J. Walker and apparently has got a Netflix deal, is going to be, you know, an 8-part series on Netflix about Madam C.J. Walker. Those kinds of stories, even the longest traditional movie, would be, what, 4 hours max? I mean, Gone with the Wind was sort of the threshold there, unless you went into Showa country. And, and I'm not sure how many people actually saw that in the theaters. But it seems to me that also that episodic nature and also being able to stretch the canvas changes the audience's expectations about what a movie can be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, definitely when you offer up, you know, a 6-part series versus a 4-hour movie, you're giving people a lot more, you know, broader opportunity to tell a story and more detailed story with some additional content that maybe wasn't in there before.
Teresa?
I think that that's, you know, I think that's kind of where we're going. And we also look at how the next generation is consuming things. I might be part of that generation. And then the one after that, it's on their phones and their tablets. It's everywhere. And that consumption, the amount of consumption that they're doing has a demand, right? Which means we have to be creating more. And so it's just continuing to create these opportunities for more of those stories in different manners. Sometimes it's a 3-minute story and it goes viral. And sometimes it is a 6-part series about someone that you never would have really gotten to see the big picture view of, someone like Madam Walker, and the way that they're doing that in any other aspect.
Yeah, like I've seen a couple of shows come out on Netflix recently that are 20-minute episodes, and there's like 8 to 10 of them.
Mm-hmm.
People consume in very quicker, you know, segments, and then they'll pick it back up, you know, a day or two later.
Well, something even I notice when I watch is that they're not trapped by those artificial time limitations for broadcast. You know, if they've only got 48 minutes of story, they use 48 minutes. If it goes to an hour and two, they do an hour and two. But, John, I want to ask if it changes as a filmmaker yourself, as someone who's in this, does it change the way you approach the storytelling? Because even with some of these massive box office hits, the reality is they're likely to be seen more often either on a television screen or a handheld device of some kind than they ever will be in, sorry, Craig, one of the four walls.
There's always going to be a place for movie theaters.
Well, don't worry, I'm going to come back to that because I want to talk about what we lose in that.
Well, people have always been hungry for good storytelling. I mean, that's since the Greeks, people want to hear really, really good stories. But in the past, the only way to see that was in a movie theater or through network television. And network television is really expensive to produce. So they, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 years ago, realized that they could make a lot more money by doing reality TV. And I have my quote fingers up with reality TV. So there was, I think maybe it was NBC or someone put a mandate out that said, we're no longer doing scripted content. Because you're paying Jerry Seinfeld $1 million an episode. It's just not. And they can do Big Brother for, you know, pennies.
Yeah.
They would just rather do that, you know. Mm-hmm. So then it kind of opened up. And then HBO said, here come the Sopranos. And that went nuts. And people were like, oh, thank you. Finally, good storytelling. Mm-hmm. But it was the internet. Once the internet came out, and we could all access that pretty readily, it was like, oh, well, here's, you can get content out and not spend a whole lot of money on it. And then it's more, you can make a lot more money on it. If obviously, if you spend less, you make more when you sell it. So that really opened up. And now it's really iTunes and Amazon that really hold the keys to transactional video on demand. Your Netflix is subscription, so you pay a flat amount every month and get to watch content. But if you want to see something on iTunes, on your Roku, or on your Apple TV, you sit right at home and you watch it, and you can see it. You can see it right there.
Well, I guess where I was going with that, though, John, is does it change the way you try to tell, or even the stories you select? I mean, I'm thinking of the example that's coming to mind right now. Isn't Lawrence of Arabia, you know, the classic shot of Omar Sharif coming out of the desert for the first time that apparently took like months to get right and was a massive expense in a theater in the four wall that we're talking about. That is an absolutely overwhelming and stunning expense or experience, but a little bit less so on your iPhone.
Yeah.
So,
well, I mean, I think from a production standpoint, we're not making movies.
Yeah.
So I think it depends on where you're looking to distribute. You know, they're not going to put Stranger Things on a large screen because it's a small story. And I think sometimes people get that wrong as they try to tell small stories on a giant screen. And, you know, it's just how big is the box, so to speak. So in terms of like Lawrence of Arabia, I mean, you're paying per minute because that film, the actual canister, is really, really expensive. But for us, I mean, we can shoot, I can fly a drone through the mountaintops for a fraction of that cost. So I think it allows us to take more risks and really compete in that wide landscape.
So we'll talk about the four wall thing here, because the part, it seems to me, that we lose with all of this is the idea of movies as a collective experience.
Correct.
And, you know, how is that changing the landscape, Craig?
It's becoming more and more important from an exhibition standpoint or from a theater standpoint that, you know, A, you have the best equipment, so you're showing it in the best fashion. You've got the best sound. You're creating, you're eventizing it all so that you are bringing people out. And, you know, you are showing these movies that, you know, people want to experience in a very social setting. You know, perfect example, Black Panther is a very popular film that, you know, everybody wants to go and make a night out of it. It's kind of going back to what cinema used to be. When, you know, I doubt we'll get there, but when people wear tuxes to the movie theater, right? It is a night out. It is.
Oh, you mean people don't do that now?
I mean, I do. But,
open night.
Yeah, but it's an event, right? And I've, you know, I think we've all heard the stories of Steven Spielberg and George Lucas talking about how, you know, movie theaters are going to get to the point where it's $40, $50, $60 to see a movie. I don't know if it's going to get there, but it is going to be part of the life cycle of a film that, you know, the bigger ones or the ones that are wildly popular are going to see theatrical. You're going to start seeing some of these multiplexes condense down into smaller houses, maybe not necessarily the way it used to be where it was a mom and pop, you know, two theater operation on town square. But you're going to see fewer and fewer, like, cinemas out there. They're just going to get bigger and bigger and become more of the, you know, the dine-in theater operations. So it is more of an event. It is more of a night out. I think there, you know, movies are now being made with, you know, this is going to have theatrical. This is not going to have theatrical. And there's plenty of room in the sandbox for everybody. So, you know, you have your big budget movies that are going to see theater screen time, and you're going to have the ones that are going to see Netflix in smaller screen size. And that's, you know, that's good for those theaters that are willing to adapt and change and give the audience what it is that they want, which is a premium experience that they can't get at home or on their cell phone. You know, and to the point, I think, you know, filmmakers are going to make movies with the intent of seeing it on a movie screen. Like, if it, you know, you're never going to shoot a movie that, you know, you hope people are going to watch on their phone. It just so happens that you can watch it on your phone. So, you know, you're going to get those movies that fly under the radar and then jettison back into, you know, that theater situation, you know, Phantom Thread or Call Me By Your Name or some of these movies that maybe played that art house circuit, but now they're in mainstream AMCs and Regals now. So,
well, is that the case, though, John? I mean, can you see people actually targeting, saying, I have a story that would be perfect
For
the phone or for the smart.
Well, sure. I mean, in Europe especially, and people are, you know, they make content for your bus ride, you know, so you're going to watch something in 12 minutes from here to there, which is more popular in Europe than it is in the United States. But listen, we as human beings want to come together in general. And even when we're watching on our, if you're watching Game of Thrones from home, like, people will live tweet, you know, like, they want to experience it together. And I can tell you, as a filmmaker, films play way better in a theater than they do. You know, I've watched The Good Catholic with someone sitting next to me, and they have a certain response. I watch it in a theater, and it's a completely
different experience.
And people want to experience things together and share ideas. And what did you think? And how did you
feel about it? You'll laugh at times when you didn't laugh before. Like, it's a group think scenario, and it changes the dynamic of a movie.
Absolutely. And movies come out of theater. I have a theater background, and I trained as an actor on the stage. And we just kind of – theater was a vehicle for us, for more people to see a stage show, so to speak. So in general – I'd say in its origin, it is an experience that people want to have together.
Teresa, does that complicate the task of figuring out how you create inducements for people to make films here? Because it sounds like there no longer really is a one-size-fits-all model for doing this.
Oh, incentives apply to all content creation. there's really no – it's not just film. You know, the legislation we've been talking about is – film and media, right? And it has to look to the future. It has to look to the smaller screen content that's being created, the Netflix, the Amazon. I mean, Netflix still goes where there's incentives. They might be making films or television shows for the small screen, but they still financially want that incentive. And they're still spending the same amount of money, if not more money, on the content they're creating for the small screen. That's what I think is really interesting here, is that Game of Thrones, whoa, those budgets, right? Whoa, those the production
movies.
Value,
they're
right?
Budgets.
They're movie budgets. It's exceptional. And one thing I just want to comment on the four-wall concept is that I think also when people go to the movies is a reflection of what's going on in our society. And I think right now there's a lot of issues that people want to come together around and understand. And that's why Black Panther did so well. And society's been craving that kind of storytelling for that demographic. And I think that we're in a reflection of time where people are more wanting to get together, to feel like they're not alone, and to react to the things going on around them.
We are talking about the state of movies here in Indiana. My guests are Craig Mentz from Indie Film Fest, Teresa Sabatine with Film Indie, and John Armstrong of Pegasus Pictures. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org or find us on social media. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking about the state of movies in Indiana, this being Academy Award season. My guests are Craig Mentz from Indie Film Fest, Teresa Sabatine with Film Indie, and John Armstrong of Pegasus Pictures. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, track us down on Twitter at WFYI, or you can do what a listener named Judy has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Judy, you're on the air.
Judy Singleton here.
Oh, okay.
And hi, John Armstrong.
Hello, Judy. How are you?
Good. I called in because I wanted to talk to the point of investors in these independent films. I'm an investor by chance and then by choice of four independent films. And my first one in Indiana was with John and Zach in The Good Catholic. And I wanted to talk about first, why did I invest when there's no real infrastructure here or a reason to think that it would be successful? And I met with John and Zach, and they were so enthused and passionate about their project. But bigger than that, they truly were committed to coming back to Indiana and helping establish a film industry here as an economic development tool for us. So I invested because of their passion, a really good story, and then it's like being part of possibly an economic development trend. I reached out to several people who could have invested, who were from IU and love IU, and I was not able to find investors because filmmaking is as an investment, it's hard to analyze and figure out what kind of financial benefit you could get out of it. And with the other three films I'm in, one was actually made in Chicago, one was made in Philadelphia, and one was made in New York. And all those decisions were based on the tax credits these states provided to the filmmaker.
Judy, I think you've given us a lot here to chew on. Let me give John, because you've prompted a couple of questions, but thank you very much for the call here.
Thank you, Judy. Judy's been such a great advocate for this because she does, and she is a mover in state politics too, and understands that, again, build it and they will come. There's a lot of opportunity for economic development with the right kind of investments in this space. And she speaks to one point that I wanted to make about all these platforms, in that there are several ways to monetize a film. What people normally do is go to a website called Box Office Mojo to find out if a film has made money. But if you look at our film, all the channels of revenue that we take in are not listed on that website. That's strictly box office. Mm-hmm. So when we're on transactional video on demand, subscription video on demand, cable, satellite TV on demand. We have a Netflix deal. We have international distribution. There's a Latin America deal. I mean, there's so many ways to monetize a film and make money on it that it's just not a
bad thing. If I could jump in there. She spoke, though, to the hesitation of getting other people to sign on here. And obviously the stories about accounting practices in the film industry are notorious. I mean, the jokes about how, you know, Gone with the Wind still hasn't shown a profit or whatever after all these years because of the way that the books are kept. And she seemed to be alluding to that it's hard to take a look at it and see a simple P&L.
Yeah, I mean, when we provide them a PPM, it's just risk. People just want to see, like, how do I get my money back? And so we had to answer that question to folks, and we were able to say with, you know, some reasonable amount of certainty, like, these are the channels to monetizing this film, and here's how we feel like we can get you your money back. And, hey, if it reaches the mainstream, then maybe you can make a lot of money. So people don't – you're not – as an investment, you're not going to see that really nice standard 4 to 7% growth that people see in investment. And, you know – you can invest in a shoe factory and if you like shoes, or you can invest in an IRA and sit on your couch and not really experience it, or be a part of an industry, and especially if you have a personal tie to it here in Indiana, it makes a lot of sense from a lot of angles.
Teresa, you're looking like you want to say something.
Well, I want to say one thing to Judy's point about economic development. So when you're diversifying your assets, if you will, and if you care about your community, that money that you're giving those filmmakers is going right back into that community, right? So you're paying for your money might pay for the catering, which is a local caterer that has a small business that's trying to sustain itself. It might create jobs for students that normally wouldn't get to work and get the experience they need to make it in the real world. And so that is money right back into the community that you believe in. And also, when you talk about mitigating risk, it's not really something that we can do that well in the industry. But I think, one, it's a lot harder now to have bad accounting. I mean, it's such a transparent world and information is so accessible. Like, I don't think that there are a lot of people still doing that kind of dirty old Hollywood accounting that I mean.
Well, and I would assume with $500,000 budget,
right,
it's a little harder to
than
a $300 million budget.
And so, then also, I think that there are a lot of independent filmmakers that are building funds, and that's something that John has done. And so you look at an investment and you say, okay, we've got six projects, and there's an opportunity for one of them to do really, really well, and we believe in this one because we could get the better talent for it, et cetera. But then we've got these other five projects, and if you invest in our fund, then you've mitigated the risk by saying, if one of these does well out of the six, then we're probably going to be up on our money. And I know that a lot of filmmakers have done that successfully around the U.S., and that's a way that they're getting investors to see that there's opportunity to maybe not have as much risk involved.
Craig, I want to give you a chance to weigh in, too.
Well, and Jan, I'll speak to the point of, you know, going to these cities and states that do have incentives and kind of taking those stories elsewhere. I mean, it's the worst thing to see a movie that supposedly takes place in Indiana and it's not shot in Indiana, not a single scene. They've recreated everything that they need elsewhere.
The classic example, we had John Green on the air here.
The Fault in Our Stars.
Not long before The Fault in Our Stars was going to be released, and he was almost, you know, crying about the fact that it couldn't be shot in Indiana, that they just could not.
Like, didn't even do a flyover, I don't think. Just, you know, it was completely taken elsewhere. And you're
Pittsburgh,
seeing that. Pittsburgh.
Looks nothing like Indianapolis, but that's a whole other story.
So, you know, you see this, and, you know, it's mortifying as a person. You know, I've lived my entire life here, and it's like, I hate to see that happen. You want to bring it here. If it's a story about Indiana, it's like, imagine Hoosiers shot in, like, you know, Kansas. I mean, that doesn't make any sense.
And it's outside capital. That's the thing. Like, if you want a company to spend money in Indiana and you're worried about giving him a tax incentive, it's money that's not going to come here regardless.
Well, it seems to me there are two issues here, because if we're using Judy's call here, she's based here. Mm-hmm. Yes, she invested some of her money here, but some of her money is going to these other places. So it's not just outside capital. It is our own capital that is leaving the state.
100%. I have those calls. I have an investor who is a great fan of film, and he's been investing in Kentucky but he's a Hoosier, right? And I also have a movie in Notre Dame that I've been begging to get here and working on incentives for, that's about Haley Scott, who was part of that early 1993 bus crash. When they were building that team for Notre Dame, the women's swimming team, where two freshmen died and Haley was paralyzed. and she was told she'd never walk again, and she swam again, and she won her first meet back at Notre Dame. And that story is on the cusp of bringing it here and telling that story from the Notre Dame campus, which would be the third movie ever to film on that campus. And they're looking at Illinois because we can't offer an incentive. So daily I have these conversations with about Hoosier stories that are not staying here because we can't incentivize.
We've gotten an email question from a listener named Leslie. And if you want to join the conversation by email, you can send your email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Leslie writes, I'm one of those film actors that left Indiana and has come back, but this market is much different to me. How do I even begin? Agent, classes, theater? Thanks, Leslie. I'll throw that. I guess everybody seems to be looking in John's direction. So we'll start there.
Theater. Go to the theater. Please go to the theater. I think this is just an issue in America in general because I feel like, I'm generalizing dramatically, but the best actors in Hollywood didn't train on the stage anymore, and they were coming from Great Britain and in Ireland and Scotland and Australia because they have a national theater. So, yes, please train. Get really, really good skill to make sure that when you're given the opportunity, you can deliver. There are some local agencies in town that are trying to do their best to get commercials filmed here and be able to supply those commercials with talent. So I would check out those local agencies, absolutely, and then get on-camera acting classes as well.
Well, find a clan. I mean, seriously, there are groups of people that, you know, go out and shoot movies on a fairly regular basis. Mm-hmm. Like, find a group of people that, you know, you mesh with and get in their stuff. I mean, 48-hour film fest, you know, get out there, put your face on screen, and you'll start seeing a lot more return.
We said that don't wait for someone else to give you an opportunity to do your job. I had never been on a film set before we produced The Good Catholic, and my business partner, Zach, was really looking to break into feature films. He'd done a lot of television, been on Broadway. He's like, I want to do a feature film, and he was auditioning. He's like, forget it. I'm just going to make my own feature film. Mm-hmm. So he did.
We are talking about the state of film here in Indiana. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what Carl has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Carl, you're on the air.
Hi, guys.
Hey, Carl.
Hi, Carl.
What's on your mind?
Well, I have this is Carl Donninger. I've actually consulted with Teresa, and I've worked directly with Craig as well. And hi, John. We don't know each other yet. But,
can't wait to meet you.
I'm curious, Teresa, since the last year's legislation went so poorly, what is going on differently this year?
Thanks much for the call, Carl. We'll try to get a question. Teresa.
Well, I would say that efforts at the State House are never done poorly. Every conversation that we're having is a step towards a positive outcome. I've been told by a lot of people that have been at the State House before for many, many years that it can take 10 years to pass a law. I don't want that to happen to us, but it's a dedicated effort. We've met with the governor. We've met with the lieutenant governor. We've met with a lot of key legislators. I know that they're interested in continuing to talk about it. It's not a budget year, so actually this isn't a year where they can allocate funds. So a lot of what we've done is educate them more and more and more on the benefits of this as a actual big push from the state. So instead of just saying, hey, we have these filmmakers here, this is a cultural effort. And so we're really talking about it from a holistic point of view of how that meets the governor's agenda for innovation and growing those small businesses, how it aligns with the tech industry. And so we've had successful conversations, but it's looking like 2019 is going to be the year where they're actually going to put pen to paper if they do. And we think that we're really set up to do that. We could use a lot of more grassroots support, especially from universities and students. You know, we need to show that this isn't just me and Phil Mindy up at the State House asking for this, but that there's an actual shift from all the people that live here, the people that are graduating from our programs, the people that run those programs, that know this is important not only to the culture, but to the bottom line.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Sally. Again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Sally writes, thanks for your show today. I also like the credits for The Good Catholic since my daughter was an intern on the project production. She has relocated to California to study at UCLA and continue working in film. I would love for her to have the opportunity to return to Indiana to work.
Anytime.
By the way, love the heart behind The Good Catholic. I highly recommend watching this film. How many of these folks are we losing?
A lot of them.
Yeah.
Hundreds. I've had 5 conversations in the past 6 weeks of people leaving Indiana. They come to me and they say, I want to stay. I can't find a creative job. I can't find an opportunity. What can you do for me? And I say, well, I can connect you with Talent Fusion and you can get in their database. I can connect you with Helen Wells, or hey, here are some groups that are making short films, but when they want to create an actual income and a life, like a livelihood from this, I have to look them in the eye and say, I haven't made the kind of headway on legislation that we need for you to actually get the kind of jobs you need, so you need to do what's best for you.
Well, I can't tell you how many filmmakers I've dealt with over the years that have ties to Indiana, that came here, studied here, grew up here, and are like, man, I'd love to come back, but it's like, there's just nothing there for me at this point.
But that's a traditional complaint about the arts. I mean, I remember Kurt Vonnegut was a friend of mine, and talking with him once, and he said, you know, no one sane writes to make money. He said, or creates art to make money. You do it to feed your soul. And if you're lucky.
Yeah, but this isn't just arts. This is economic development. This is infrastructure development. This is something that breathes into every other industry that Indiana is already playing ball in. So it's not just, oh, we want to support our artists. Look at us. We want to make art. No, these are commodities that we're making. They're things that sell, that make millions and billions of dollars in the market. And we want to be people that can do that.
And my line is always that filmmaking and media production is the cross section of culture and commerce. It's not nonprofit work I'm doing here. I'm doing for-profit work, and I'm not in this because, yes, I want to tell stories, and I am a story. I'm a storyteller, but I'm in this because I want to grow a business and I want to make money, and I want to make money for other people too, and I want to do that in the place where I want to be. I had to leave Indiana to do that in the beginning, but you know, we're pulling up by our bootstraps and trying to make this happen here for ourselves. And so we've had two feature films in Bloomington so far. We've had internship programs on both of those films. And in our second film, we hired 5 of our interns from the first film into paid jobs in the second film. So now we have kids who've worked on 2 feature films in large roles, hands-on experience. And our hope is they're going to go out to the industry and be a gopher getting coffee somewhere and go, wait a second, I was doing feature films in Indiana. Maybe I should go back home. So we want to create, I know Teresa also is working very hard to create a landscape here where those kids can say, hey, I just want to stay home.
We're getting tight on time. I'm going to try to squeeze a call in. Sonny, you're on the air.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me.
Certainly.
This call is directed toward Teresa. In terms of looking at television stations in Indiana, I know a lot of them have 2 and 3 different channels. How possible is that to work with those particular stations around town to see about getting programs there that can actually, you know, be used to get people to put commercials behind these particular films and hopefully create some sort of a market share of the market in that area?
Thanks very much for the call, Sonny. Teresa.
So we have started some of those conversations. I'm sitting in a building right now with them, you know, that I would love for that to happen. I know a lot of those stations are kind of getting into that original content. It comes down to money. So those shows have to be financed. And most of these stations, you know, have limited financing for original content. But it is something that we're working on. We're looking to build an actual 501(c) fund to actually invest, create grant programs for content like that, which would then equal distribution through those channels. So part of, you know, what we need, again, is that investment. And whether if that's not tax incentives, then we need local money that can give these filmmakers and these content creators the money that they need to create the content for that pipeline. So we're definitely having those conversations, and it's a work in progress.
I think that'll have to be the last word. We've run to the end of the hour here. I would like to thank my guest, Craig Mentz from Indie Film Fest, Teresa Sabatine with Film Indie, and John Armstrong of Pegasus Pictures for what has been a lively and informative conversation about the state of the movies here in Indiana. Thank you all. I enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you so much.
It was good to have you here. I'd like to thank all of our listeners as usual. It's great doing talk radio for the smartest audience out there, an audience with an attention span. We will be back on Thursday. We're going to be talking about the Indiana Authors Awards. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.